We enter into chapter 9, which is Sankhya, Yoga and Vedanta. In chapter 10, in the beginning, Sri Aurobindo himself says that last two chapters have been dedicated. We have had to take the reader through the metaphysical background. So they are a bit of philosophical, and some of us may want immediately easy to do practices and exercises. But without a background, if we do exercises, then we land up in the same situation where works without knowledge. So whenever behind every practice, there is a background and a basis. If we don't understand the basis and we plunge into practice, then that practice may lead in a very different direction altogether. So there are a number of examples we could take of that. So that's why Sri Aurobindo is taking so much pains to tell us about the background of the Gita. It has used certain terms, and those terms have to be understood in the real sense. There is a literal meaning of the word, and there is the deeper sense. Word is, after all, an instrument. It's a means. So there have been tendencies in the human mind to make the word sacrosanct. And when we make the word sacrosanct, we very often forget the consciousness and we forget the spirit behind it. And it does great damage. It has done to the religions. There is a tendency to do it very often. Sri Aurobindo says, thus said the mother, thus said Sri Ramakrishna, thus said spoke Vivekananda. And we have this same tendency of quoting mother. Mother speaks about it, that people say, mother likes this, mother does not like this, and they quote. Now we miss the essence, because literal meaning is something else, and this is something, one of the things that Sri Aurobindo brings out here in this chapter. For example, there is a whole conversation of the mother on one of her statements, cling to truth. We find it when we go to Sri Aurobindo's room. And she says, people use it and quote it to me. They even quote writings from the mother. This has been very widely circulated also, that Sri Aurobindo has said, do not imagine that truth and falsehood can stay together in the same place. Now, you know, it is being quoted, or rather misquoted, to remind others that you are in falsehood, not looking at oneself. Besides, what is Sri Aurobindo saying? We can look at it very simply, that if you harbor the two together, ultimately truth will have the win. So why don't you align with it? It's a very nice advice, very parent-like advice, but we turn it in our mind as if there is a judgmental God who is holding a stick and saying, do not imagine truth and falsehood will stay together. So this is how scriptures get misquoted, and especially with passage of time, and wherever there is a tendency to take the scripture and forget the spirit behind it, then there is a problem. Over a period of time, it becomes a hardened, crystallized religion. And the harm it does to this earth, we all know. So in Indian thought, also this tendency was there, because it's a human tendency. So every time a great truth was revealed, then there was a tendency to convert it into easy to practice formulas, which is what we all want. Tell us something easy to do. Now, people convert it into formulas. The moment you convert it into formula, initially, that formula is well connected with the inner truth. For example, prostrating or lying down at the feet of the guru. Now, it's an expression of the inner feeling that I want to completely surrender myself. So, body wants to participate. So, there is a spontaneous urge to bow down at the feet of the master. As the mother once recounted, that first time she understood why it is done in India. Because when she met Sri Aurobindo, she bowed down instinctively. And she realized that yes, why it is done, and how the power flows from the feet of the guru to the master, to the disciple. But at the same time, bowing down mechanically with no feeling in the heart or with contrary things, it doesn't help. So there is that famous story of Sri Aurobindo, which is recounted by Champaklalji, that when he came to do pranam. So when Champaklalji did pranam, for 1 hour, Sri Aurobindo stood where he was. He was in that state of pranam. But there is equally another story where somebody did the pranam. When he got up, Sri Aurobindo had moved away. He was no more there because the same act. So the problem with religion has been twofold. One is giving too much importance to the word meaning, literal meaning of a scripture, of the scripture. And the second is too much of outer rituals. And my own feeling, people often say that, you know, why Sanatan Dharma went into decline. There are several causes, but one of them is that whenever there is too much of external things, almost it's like controlling every sphere of life. Morning you should do this, afternoon you should do this, evening you should do this, night you should do this, for a baby you should do this, for death you should do this. When there is so much of external control of life, then the priest step in, and if you have not done it that way, then there is a papa and there is a prashchit and 100 things. So human mind gets lost in that maze and forgets the one needful truth. And that one needful saving truth is the divine within. So in Indian thought it was, this tendency came in, but it was always corrected by the fresh stream of spiritual infusion of spiritual consciousness, spiritual realization. That was the saving grace. Otherwise it could have become like any other religion. And each such fresh infusion took up whatever was available at that point of time and fused it with what was happening in the future, going to come in the future. And we have spoken about it, how Sri Krishna fused, synthesized all the prevalent ideas at that point of time because it was a necessity. Otherwise they would have said another Krishna cult. The people have done it over a period of time. Now we have Krishna's cult. Now what is Krishna's cult? Krishna's cult, if ever, it has to be infinite. Or for that matter, what is Christ's cult? It has to be infinite. You can't. What is Sri Aurobindo's cult? You can't confine him to a few centers and few places. Yes, those are special places. But Mother is everywhere, in everything, everyone. So this fresh stream which Sri Krishna brought with him, brought in some new elements. So what were the old elements which are prevalent? As we discussed last time, it was Sankhya, Yoga and Vedanta. Now the way we use these words is very different from the way they were understood during the time of Krishna. Sankhya nowadays hardly anybody uses. You won't normally find it in average discourse. But it was one of the authoritative path. Now, because new things came up, Buddhism came, Jainism came, all this was not there. They drew from the Sankhya discipline, but they developed something of their own. Even Vedanta, for that matter, it ultimately, in the end of it, it also spoke that there is the Prakriti and there is the Purusha, but it spoke about two Purushas and sometimes hinted at the third Purusha, but essentially the Purusha was the witness and therefore knowledge was the highest. And what did this knowledge mean? Knowing the one who is behind nature. So, of course, there were variations. He's the Lord, the Ishwara. But essentially the witness Purusha. So this is what Sankhya says. Vedanta also at that point of time, it meant basically the path of knowledge. Sankhya also meant the path of knowledge. And Vedanta cut away the ritualistic part of the Vedas and went to the essence. So Vedanta is Upanishads. They have culled out from the Vedas. And whatever is Karma Kanda, so all the karma can't do this, don't do this. Those familiar with Hindu thought know it very well. From morning till night, there are all kinds of things. Hardly anybody follows and hardly anybody knows because it's a very liberal kind of a religion anyways. But there is the Gyan Kanda. Gyan Kanda is about that aspect which leads us to the higher knowledge. And in Upanishads itself, we find that there is a distinction made between the higher knowledge, which is discovering the divine reality by the path shown in the Vedas, and the second, where one is lost in the maze of words. So people do path. Now we have this tradition also of Savitri path, and we have Veda path, and we have, you know, Upanishad. It's okay, but that's not the ultimate thing. You know, it's not a mechanical performance of path. It is there in Indian tradition. People do part and it doesn't really change them because they are not dwelling on the essence. They don't want to live that life. It's not easy to live that life. So all these aspects were there in Sri Krishna's consciousness. He had taken all these elements and then he was giving a truth which will be helpful for man to take the journey from the end of Dwapar, beginning of Kaliyug, till, if I may say so, Sri Krishna returned again at the end of Kaliyug and gave us a new Gita or Super Gita, which is Savitri. Because now the Kaliyug is ending and the journey of Satyug will be another kind of battle. And so Sri Aurobindo or Sri Krishna comes again as Sri Aurobindo and gives us Savitri. Because now many things have happened during the last 4,000 years. They have to be taken up, integrated. Many new paths have come, which were not during the time of Sri Krishna. Christ himself, Christianity was not there, Islam was not there, Buddhism was not there, Jainism was not there, Sikhism was not there, their fundamental truths was not there. Tantra, the way it has come up now, it was not there. So Sri Krishna's work was restricted to, confined to synthesizing these three main movements, which were primarily Sankhya, which is the way of knowledge, very closely similar to Vedanta. The terminologies are different. Sankhya will use the word Purush and Vedanta will use another term. It will use the word Brahman, and Brahman as the sole reality. It will use the word Atman. Buddha uses a similar truth, but he gives it a different term. He says he doesn't use the word Atman. Because if you look at Sankhya's Purusha, it is essentially, it is inactive. It doesn't do anything. It is almost like Jada. He is not doing anything, but he is watching, witnessing everything. It's a pure awareness. So a pure awareness which doesn't have the power to change anything, that's how the whole thing goes. So it became an atheistic religion. Because there is nobody to relate to. Purusha is a witness. He is watching. You pray to him, there is no response. You call him father, mother, sister, brother. Nothing. He doesn't respond because all that belongs to Prakriti. He has nothing to do with Prakriti. But Sri Krishna brings in this element which is there hinted in the Upanishads. For instance, Upanishad speaks about Brahman but goes deeper into the Supreme Brahman. The Supreme Purusha, that's how it puts it. And it describes the qualities of the Purusha at one place. For example, in the Isha Upanishad. Now, that is only hinted. And Sri Krishna develops it into the Purushottama. And it's a big difference. Because Purushottama, the Uttam Purusha, he holds the other two modes of his own being. They are not inferior. They are part of his own aspects. And he is one from whom this universe has emerged. He is immanent in the universe. Sankhya's Purusha is not immanent in the universe. Similarly, the illusionist Brahman is not immanent in the universe. He has nothing to do with the universe except that by some inexplicable Maya. Sankhya doesn't speak about Maya. The Gita uses the word Maya but in a very different sense. It says there is a Maya, but it is ultimately the divine's own Maya. For some reason, because of it, we experience the world the way we experience it. In Sankhya, it doesn't need to bring in Maya. It says there is Prakriti. Why do you want to know why Prakriti is, what it is basis? There is Prakriti. And if you remain tied to Prakriti, there is no hope for you. You have to first step out of this to understand about yourself. It doesn't care about understanding Prakriti because it was already explained. Prakriti is composed of these 23 elements. That's the end. That's what one needs to know. You can play with those elements and you can do many things. I mean, as I said, it speaks about how a Parmanu is formed. That knowledge has come to the Rishi. But he says this knowledge is not what is important. You have to ultimately come out of Prakriti. Then only you will know who you are. It's like unless you go into space, you can gather all the information about Earth. But there are certain things you can know only when you enter into space. So this was the whole thing about Sankhya. We see something very similar in Yoga of Jnana Yoga and Vedanta, which is essentially all about the end of knowledge, as Vedanta literally means end of knowledge. So it is the Jnana which is contained in the Vedas. So what is the position of Jnana with regard to works, karma? Because yoga is about works. So traditional interpretation of Vedanta is that works are necessary till you have jnana. After you have jnana, the utility of works is over. And what kind of works are necessary? Ceremonial and ritualistic. That's what it means by works. So it is not meaning that, you know, you can do anything and everything, have a gala life and say by works somehow. Well, that even the Gita doesn't say that way. But Gita says sarva karmani, all works. But the traditional Vedantic interpretation is that you must engage in basically ritualistic works. So Vedanta tried to reconcile the Vedvad or the ritualistic aspects of the Vedic religion by saying, yes, ceremonial works may continue, should continue, and through these ceremonial works you become prepared for jnana. And in part of that work includes scriptural reading. So you read the scriptures, you continue to do the ceremonies, you invoke the gods and goddesses, they are all there, till finally you discover the one self behind all things. The moment you discover oneself, all this stops. So what about people who have discovered the oneself? Sri Raman Maharishi is there, there are others. What do? So they don't need to do anything. Why are they continuing? They are continuing, they may continue, they may leave. They have nothing to do with this world. It's up to them. But actually speaking, there is no need to continue because they have found their liberation. This is the basic. But that's not what Sri Krishna's purpose is. Sri Krishna's purpose is that not only works will help us to arrive at that state of knowledge, but having arrived at that state of knowledge, there is something more which we can be engaged in. But here comes very perplexing statements from Sri Krishna which confuses Arjuna. For example, he says, knowledge is superior to works. So what does it mean? Here it means works which are done in ignorance. Even as common sense we can understand it. If I am given a task to make, let's say, khichdi, I don't know how to make khichdi. So while I am doing the work, I need to know. Even at the most pragmatic level, knowledge must precede works. If I don't have the knowledge, the work will be faulty. And that, if anything, is the real utility of reading a scripture. We are all working for Mother, but how? What should be our state, our attitude, our inner condition when we are working? So that knowledge is important. So when Sri Krishna says knowledge is more higher than works, then Arjuna says, wait, hold on. You are just telling me fight. You have given me a whole lot of lecture on Kshatriya and Dharma and all that. Now you are telling me knowledge is superior to works. So what is Sri Krishna doing? This, he does both these things in chapter 2. He initially impels Arjun, you fight, it's your Swadharma, you're a Kshatriya. You can't run away from all this. Whereas, soon thereafter, he starts entering into Sankhya. And that Vedantic aspect that, look here, Arjun, knowledge is superior to works. He is bewildered. He says, tell me one thing, Madhav. I know you are a trickster, but you are just, you know, confusing my intelligence. If you read chapter 2, it seems like a sudden departure. So Sri Krishna explains and Sri Aurobindo elaborates it beautifully. Many people quote chapter 2 of the Gita to eventually say that gospel, it's not really a gospel of works, it's a Vedantic work which is all about essence of Upanishads. But if you read the whole of Gita, that's not what Sri Krishna is saying. So why does he speak of the Aryan Dharma and Swadharma in the beginning? Because Sri Krishna knew that under the spell of Sankhya, Vedanta, Jnana Yoga, people are withdrawing from works completely. They are not only stopping the rituals, stopping the rituals is okay, but they are taking that course that ultimately all works is illusion. Illusionism had not come the way it came post-Shankara, but they are disregarding it. Now that's not the way to have an integral life. So he says you must live, but live as an Arya. So he's integrating the way of life of those days with Vedanta. And that's what Buddha also said. Later on we interpreted him as illusionistic, but Buddha also uses the word Arya. How a man should be, he should be compassionate, he must be having the spirit of service to mankind. Arya discipline was much more. So there is an inner culture which a person should be engaged in. And we cannot engage in this inner self culture without works. Because when we work, then only our inner issues come up. Somebody who is sitting in meditation all the time like a stone, or well, like a god. As Pada says, I have neither the condition of a god nor the of a sage. Because if you stay that way, you don't know what really, they can be very crude natures. So that's why it's so important. Mother says that in one of her early prayers, that works are important, because through works we become aware of certain aspects in our nature. Somebody tells us something which we don't like, we become aware of anger. We become aware of unhappiness. We become aware that we are holding ourselves in low self-esteem. Somebody praises us, we start climbing on cloud nine as if we are somebody very special. So it is through works that we become conscious, and works help us in gaining knowledge. And even after gaining knowledge, we can continue with all kinds of works. So Sri Krishna expands the scope. So he synthesizes yoga and Vedanta. Yoga is works. And he says all kinds of works, not just ritualistic work, not just few works. Every work can be a help in gaining knowledge. So Vedanta speaks about inner meditation. Sri Krishna says doing works you can arrive at the same knowledge, which is a very big change. And thanks to him that all of us who are, you know, actively engaged in life have been at some point, can have a hope. Because before that it was, if you are taking the path of yoga, which is works, you engage in ceremonial works, certain proscriptions and prescriptions, then ultimately you are ready for the deeper meditation and samadhi. That's what Raj Yoga and Patanjali Yoga Sutras are. On the other hand, Vedanta said, cut it all. Go within, discover the one, and that's it. Something very similar, Sankhya says. But Sri Krishna says, no, you can be engaged in all the works, sarva karmani. And yet, all the time being engaged in work, if you do it in the way that he is going to tell us, teach us, then we will arrive at the same knowledge, in fact something still higher, and we can again continue to do works. And why he says that? Because normally we consider work is a bondage, because when you get into work, you will get attached to people, you will get attached to ideas, opinions, ways of doing. So people start shunning work, because if I enter into it, but Sri Krishna shows us a path through works to arrive at the same fullness of knowledge. This is the background which Sri Krishna is building before he takes up the whole yoga. So, page 81, Sankhya, Yoga and Vedanta. And on the first paragraph, very first paragraph, somewhere in the middle, the practical difference, as it seems to have presented itself as the religious to the religious minds of that day, lay first in this, that Sankhya proceeded by knowledge and through the yoga of the intelligence, while yoga proceeded by works and the transformation of the active consciousness. This is the difference, passivity and activity. And secondly, a corollary of this first distinction, the Sankhya led to entire passivity and the renunciation of works, sannyas, while yoga held to be quite sufficient the inner renunciation of desire, the purification of the subjective principle. Subjective principle is the inner state, our thoughts, attitudes, motives, what stands behind the works. That has to be purified. Works can continue, which leads to action and the turning of works Godwards, toward the divine existence and towards liberation. Yet both had the same aim. The aim was to gain knowledge, and knowledge liberates. So in Vedanta, in Sankhya, you become passive witness to the world. World will move past, unfold, roll itself. You don't engage in it. But if you are caught up in life, then engage in ritualistic works, ceremonial works. Everything becomes a ceremony then, and whatever shesh karma, certain works you have no choice. For instance, you have a debt, you have to pay it. So everything, you have to take it that, well, that's my karma, it will cease one day. But in yoga, you don't need to leave work, so you have to leave desire. So it's an inner renunciation. Sankhya and typical Gyan Yoga, Vedantic Gyan Yoga, takes you towards, ultimately towards sannyas. That means sannyas here is abandoning outer life and all its works. Abandon your wife, your child, your family, you know, everything. So that, because they are bondages. But Sri Krishna would say, no, you don't need to abandon them. You have to reorient yourself. They are no more there to satisfy your desire. They are no more means to gratify your senses or to give you pleasure. They are there as equally manifestations of the divine, and all your emotions have to be directed toward the divine through whatever way. We may be engaged with a person who is a friend, yet our love for the friend should not be for any selfish personal desire, but for the divine presence. See the divine presence in the person and direct it towards him consciously. That is the fundamental truth of the Gita. The teacher, next passage, sets out by reconciling works and the yoga of the intelligence. The latter, he says, is far superior to mere works. Yet are works a means of salvation, but works thus purified by knowledge. Last line here on this page. Yet are works a means of salvation, but works thus purified by knowledge. So this is where Arjuna is bewildered. He has said that knowledge is far superior to works. What is he referring? Doing works in ignorance. Where is knowledge? So he says, first you have to gain knowledge by whatever means. And then at the same time he says, what we read, yet are works a means of salvation, but works thus purified by knowledge. What is this knowledge? For example, this knowledge that the divine dwells in all. How does it purify work? Because when I am working now, if I am working, if I am aware that this is the divine who is dwelling in all, then whatever work I am doing will become a service to the divine. As I think I mentioned this, somebody wrote to Sri Aurobindo, I am working in dining room, so how is it your service? I am serving the sadhaks. I have not come here to serve the sadhaks. Very logical. I have come here to serve you. Even now people feel sometimes. Those who were directly serving the mother and Sri Aurobindo were more special. But that's not the case. Sri Aurobindo says, in that case, I am also writing so many letters to the sadhaks and mother is making all the arrangement for the sadhaks. So you mean to say that I am also serving the sadhaks? So when we have the state that it's not sadhaks, anybody. And that is the principle behind certain aspects of Indian culture. For instance, when a guest comes home, when a man of wisdom comes home, or during yajnas, when the priests come, you wash their feet. They are representatives of the divine. It's not that man. Man may stupidly feel it's me. That's his stupidity. But this whole culture was based around seeing the divine presence. Women are Devi, and the man who comes is Devata. Devata in the sense, Deva, the Ishwara. So when we deal with life with the sense of the sacred, that there is a divine in all, then we are purified by knowledge. When we know that the divine is within me, then how does this knowledge purify me? Then can I lay claim to anything? People love to lay claim. I have seen people go, I won't say where, has my book been published? Has it come out? And they are asking blatantly, how many copies are being sold? All this a man of knowledge will never even indulge. Not even it will not enter his mind. Because it's not he. You know it is the divine presence who has. That's why the Gita says, he who sees action in inaction and inaction in action, know him to be a knower. What is it meant by this? This also all is part of the chapter 2. Inaction in action. Inaction in action. So when he is doing works, he knows it's not him or her. It's the divine force that has done it. Very beautifully, there is a line from Dujendra Lal Roy, I think Dilip Kumar Roy's grandfather, if I'm not mistaken. So he was a great poet, and he writes in Bengali, तोमार कर्म तुमी करोमा लोके बोले करियामी. योर कर्मा एक्शंस योर फोर्स यू आर द डूअर. पीपल से दैट आई एम डूइंग इट. हाउ फुलिश. बट वॉट कैन आई डू. आई कांट स्टॉप पीपल. सो दिस स्टेट वेन इन एक्शन यू सी इन एक्शन बिकॉज यू आर नॉट द डूअर. एट द सेम टाइम इन एक्शन यू सी एक्शन. हाउ डू यू सी एक्शन इन एक्शन. बिकॉज यू सी दैट देर इज नेवर ए स्टेट ऑफ इन एक्शन. Even a pebble lying on the seashore is exerting an action. It's adding to the sum total of forces. A yogi meditating on the mountain top and dreaming of equality is inspiring people in France to suddenly ask for equality, fraternity and unity. So basically, even somebody who is apparently doing nothing, yet is doing something because he's engaged in his through his inner state. So this is the knowledge that Shri Krishna wants to impart us. But Arjun in the beginning is bewildered. He says, tell me one thing. You are confusing me. Inaction is action. Action is inaction. What is it you are saying, Keshav? So Arjun is perplexed and asks, if thou holdest the intelligence to be greater than works, why then dost thou appoint me to a terrible work? Not even an ordinary work. You are asking me to massacre these people. Truly speaking, you can fight such a war only in that state. When you are able to see the divine within and divine in all. Otherwise you will be filled with horror, carnage, all kinds of things. Fear. Otherwise you cannot, a good human being, a sensitive human being cannot fight. But if you see the divine presence, one divine presence, that's the story in at the end of the war, everybody is bragging who was the greatest fighter of them all. And there is that head of Barbaric, which was granted immortality, and they go and ask him, you have seen the entire war. What do you say? Who was the greatest fighter? He laughs. He says, I saw only Krishna. Krishna on this side and Krishna on that side. That is knowledge. And then when we live with that state, then grief will pass away. This what is the essence. But Arjun says, thou seemst to bewilder my intelligence with a confused and mingled speech. Look at how friendly he is to Shri Krishna. Tell me then decisively that one thing by which I may attain to my soul's weal. I want my, now I am all confused. I want my soul to arrive at its fullness. Tell me clearly, work or knowledge? And Shri Krishna says, knowledge is superior to works, but by works you will arrive at knowledge. And when you have the knowledge, your works will also change. Yoga, karmasu, kaushalam. So now he is, because we like to put things in two slots. In answer, Krishna affirms that the Sankhya goes by knowledge and renunciation, the yoga by works. But the real renunciation is impossible without yoga. Without works done as a sacrifice, done with equality and without desire of the fruit, with the perception that it is nature which does the actions and not the soul. But immediately afterwards he declared that the sacrifice of knowledge is the highest. All work finds its consummation in knowledge. So first thing is that works should be done in a certain way as sacrifice, dedication to the eternal. And this he will elaborate. So we need not dwell so much upon it, because the entire Gita is there to reveal to us. At the same time he says sacrifice of knowledge is the highest. So that's again further perplexes Arjuna. Again Arjuna is perplexed. So what is this he is speaking about? By the fire of knowledge all works are burnt up. Therefore by yoga works are renounced and their bondage overcome for the man who is in possession of his self. So what is this knowledge he is talking about? He is again and again talking that work should lead us to the realization of the oneself. There is a letter of Sri Aurobindo where he says, works are not a means to show how good you do things. They are not a means to project yourself. They are not a means to gain power, to fulfill your ambition, to occupy a chair, to occupy a certain, to become in the top brass in whichever community you are living. That's not the purpose of works. But if you have the knowledge that it is the divine who alone is, who alone does, then you will see that this knowledge will purify works and there will be no bondage at all. Because simply, you are no more the doer. As long as you think you are the doer, you are in bondage. And we will think we are the doer as long as the ego sense is active. And the day we know, and this is common sense actually. I remember as a youngster, all these thoughts going on in the mind. I used to wonder, people say that we are so intelligent. But whose intelligence is this anyways? Take it heredity, parents, society, education, whichever way you go, nature. You can't claim that this is my intelligence or I am intelligent is a foolish statement. Because intelligence is cosmic. You happen to be one of the recipient. Ant is also intelligent. In a certain way is more intelligent than you if you look at how the ants function. Very wise, very intelligent. Compared to that, man in a certain sense is much less intelligent. So, do we say ant is more intelligent than a human being? No, that's not how we look at it. There is only one intelligence operating in this cosmos. Today it is in somebody's head, tomorrow elsewhere. In different ways it is expressing itself. So when we understand that, then works are no more a bondage. They become a means of purification. Because in every field. So this is what Sri Krishna is reminding us. Few lines below. In outward inaction, to see action, still persisting. Why? Because still you are alive, your breath is an action. Your heartbeat is an action. Your thought is an action. Your feeling is an action. And in apparent action, to see a real inaction. Since the soul has renounced its illusion of the worker and given up works into the hands of the master of sacrifice. This is the principle. But Arjuna takes time. And thanks to Arjuna, we must say, thank you, Arjun. You kept asking questions. Just like people ask Sri Aurobindo, many of the Dilip Kumar Roy, Nirodha, all our gratitude to them for having asked all the questions so that today we can see it from all sides. So Arjuna again asks. He asks again, thou declarest to me the renunciation of works, O Krishna, and again thou declarest to me yoga. Yoga because it means works. That's how it was understood that time. Which one of these is the better way? That tell me with a clear decisiveness. The answer is important for it puts the whole distinction very clearly. Page 83, under quotes, second line from above. Renunciation and yoga works both bring about the soul's salvation. But of the two, the yoga works is distinguished above the renunciation of works. He should be known as always a sannyasi, even when he is doing action, who neither dislikes nor desires. For free from the dualities, he is released easily and happily from the bondage. So those who are engaged in work, they can be governing a kingdom, and yet they are free from desire and in a state of equality. They are not afflicted by the dualities of success and failure, victory and defeat. Such a person is not only yogi, he becomes a powerful instrument for the divine action in the world. There are such people who are being born, at least in India, we can see that now. And I don't want to name because that would make it political, but basically it is so evident that they are moving purely with this spirit, that they are fulfilling a purpose God has planted in their heart. They use this language also, and it's not just the language, they use it in very sincerity. He knows that the actions are not his. Again, the quote is over. He knows that the action is not his, but nature's, and by that very knowledge, he is free. So he knows that that action nature has taken or God has made him do it. So he can't claim. Well, I can't help it, but other day I was listening, not because of any political affiliation, but Honorable Prime Minister, somebody asked him this question, that how are you able to do all these things, you did that. He said, actually I don't know. He used this word. He said, actually I don't know. I just feel that God uses me and does things. And when I heard that statement, I said, here is, after all, somebody whom God has really using as an instrument, and he is conscious, he is not taking the credit. He said, I don't know how these things, this idea comes. He said, I don't know how the idea comes. I don't know how it gets executed. But I see the result eventually. But I know that it is not me. So this is the state that one has to enter into. And people may judge you. They may say good, bad. It doesn't affect. A person who is into yoga, you may hurl all the abuses. It won't affect because he is entered beyond dualities. He has renounced works, does no actions, though actions are done through him. He becomes the self, the Brahman, Brahmabhut. I can't say how far somebody has gone, but I'm just saying that this is one example. Sri Krishna gives his own example. Of course, that's at the highest level. He says, I am engaged in works. There is nothing I have to gain. Shobindu himself says, in fact, Shobindu remained engaged in work. All levels he was working. Not only inwardly, he was working on the world's cosmic action, sending forth. So many people wrote letters, so many people crying for help. And of course, he was his correspondence, all the things that mother would come and tell him about problems that are taking place. And the mother would say, all that I had to tell him was, Lord, take this, and it would be gone. She said, what is supreme security? Was it just happening by magic? Shobindu saw all that and corrected all that. He was not, people have this idea, oh, he had renounced and he was sitting in a room. He was constantly acting. Second World War is an actual example. He would listen to the radio, Pavitrada, still that connection is there. How he would tell him the news. And then when he will hear the news, he will match it to his own intuitive and super intuitive knowledge. And he would say, oh, this is where they are not right. Oh, this is propaganda. Oh, this is correct. So he would do that and he would pour himself onto the world forces, Winston Churchill's speeches, and where he would say that yes, he is a good instrument somewhere where things could have been otherwise. So he was working constantly on a much greater scale. But people say that, you know, he had renounced. Yes, of course he had renounced ego and desire, but that was done long, long back before coming to Pondicherry. So this is what Sri Krishna is wanting us to be, and we'll go a little further. Page 85. The Brahman of the Mayavadins is silent, immutable, and inactive. Mayavadins, the illusionist post Shankara, in that Vedanta of the original kind. You don't have this idea of illusion the way later on it has come through the analysis of Shankar. He had his reasons or whatever his intellectual understanding. You're not going into it. But after that, the sense of Mayavad became very strong. Possibly, as Shobindu says, because Buddha came earlier and Buddha made this whole field as if this is, he didn't use the word Maya. But anyways, it was all an illusion. So that had such a deep impact upon the psyche of the race. Shankaracharya wanted to refute the idea. And yet he could not help but eventually speak of Maya. He refuted only in the sense that Buddha speaks of Anatma and Shankaracharya speaks of Brahman or the Atma. But as far as nature is considered, Sankhya describes what nature is, but that's not where you should be. Illusionist Vedanta speaks of nature as illusion, but the self as real. Buddha says, this is illusion, and the self too is a fiction. So this is how the difference goes. And because of this impact, humanity started turning away from action. What happened in India subsequently, we all are witness. Therefore, for both ascetic renunciation, so that is Mayavadin as well as Sankhya, of life and works is a necessary means of liberation. Why would you want to be engaged in something which is untrue, which is false, unreal? That's why one of the things I don't understand it, people go to hear to these lectures on Maya, Mayavad. If you are really sincere, you can't after that, you know, engage in action. If you are sincere even by one grain, you will want to say, what is the point? Somebody is fooling me. Whoever is fooling me, why should I be fooled? Only a complete fool would like to be fooled constantly even after knowing that he is being tricked. So typically, actually, if you keep hearing these things, ideally, you should not be. And that's why the best minds turned away from works, because they took it seriously that this is what illusion is. Now, what Sri Aurobindo and Sri Krishna say, we'll come to that later. We'll keep that as a secret right now. So what is it then if not illusion? At one level, illusion is very convincing, even scientifically. But let's keep that for later on. So he says that action is not only a preparation but itself the means of liberation. This is what the Gita says. And it is the justice of this new view which the Gita seeks to bring out with such an unceasing force and insistence. An insistence, unfortunately, which could not prevail in India against the tremendous tide of Buddhism, was lost afterwards in the intensity of ascetic illusionism and the fervor of world-shunning saints and devotees, and is only now beginning to exercise its real and salutary influence on the Indian mind. And therefore, he says, renunciation is indispensable, but the true renunciation is the inner rejection of desire and egoism. Without that, the outer physical abandoning of works is a thing unreal and ineffective. You see this nowadays, recently. You know, people who are supposed to be the highest authorities in renunciation were making statements on politics. Were hurt because they were not, you know, they were told that you cannot come with all the fanfare. If you are truly renounced, why should you even be concerned who is the minister and prime minister and this and that? That you see in Devra Baba. Devra Baba, you see, actually really renunciate. People went and told him about this party, that party. He said, sab achhe aadmi. You see, I was watching a brief clip. He said, achha aadmi hai. He is a good man, he has met me. Then he said, no, no, he is doing all this. He said, no, 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 sab achha aadmi hai. End of the whole conversation. Which is, if you are really a sannyasi, then in that sense, why should you be engaged? Why should it concern you? But, well, that's how life is. So, Sri Krishna speaks of it is not the physical abandoning of works, but the inner state. Again, he says, next sentence, knowledge is essential. There is no higher force for liberation. But works with knowledge are also needed. By the union of knowledge and works, the soul dwells entirely in the Brahmic status, not only in repose and in active calm, but in the very midst and stress and violence of action. So that word is Brahma Bhuta. It's a powerful word. You are full of Brahman in all this creation and all its various activities, all the becomings. You see that one reality. That is what is required. So all this, we can skip all this. And then he says something very interesting. Sri Krishna repudiates Vedvad. Vedvad is what? That, you know, using all this karma kanda for getting this. Even now people, oh, to get a good child you should do this. To get money you should do this. All kinds of yajna are there. They were there always. But what does Sri Krishna has to say? Sri Krishna says about the Vedvad on page 87, this flowery word which they declare, who have not clear discernment, devoted to the creed of the Veda. He is not saying anything against the Veda, but the creed of the Veda. He would say the same thing about cults in the name of Krishna. Creed of the Veda, whose creed is that there is nothing else, souls of desire, seekers of paradise, it gives the fruits of the works of birth. It is multifarious with specialities of rites. It is directed to enjoyment and lordship as its goal. So these are the people who remain tied in the three gunas. And for these people, Sri Krishna says, Vedvad and he says Trikona Vishaya Vedah, that these people are tied in the three gunas. Arjun, don't get lost in that. Do this rite, do that ritual. So when we speak nowadays sometimes about revival of Hinduism, Sanatana Dharma, Veda, we again have a tendency to go back to that which Sri Krishna himself has discarded. Because we have to grow into the spirit. What does Sri Aurobindo say? He says we have to grow in that spirit, manifest the divine. And that is a far more rigorous thing than lighting a fire and chanting the mantras, the very nice things. All right. For invoking things for various earthly desires and pleasures. Even with divine, we form that relation. We can form, Sri Krishna doesn't deny it. But we should not regard that that is the essence or the spirit. That's what we discover here. When thy intelligence, last lines, when thy intelligence shall cross beyond the wall of delusion, then shalt thou become indifferent to scripture, heard, or that which thou hast yet to hear. Beautiful. When thy intelligence, which is bewildered by the Shruti, shall stand unmoving and stable in Samadhi, then shalt thou attain to yoga. And this is the great knowledge which is always there. For instance, some people say if you face this way, that way, this side should be this picture, that side, then you are again entering into that kind of a, not the true knowledge. You are still deluded. That story of Guru Nanak, when he goes and he's lying down, somebody comes and says, you are facing your feet towards Mecca. It's a sin. He says, okay, take away my feet towards wherever Mecca is not. And when he turns the feet, wherever he turns the feet, he sees Mecca, that side. So somebody once asked me that, can I put my feet in sleeping position, not, you know, it has to be understood, not like in front Mother and Shobindu's picture. When I sleep, I want to see them, but my feet is that side, what shall I do? I said, what greater joy than to see Shobindu and the mother? Anyways, they are everywhere. You're not disrespect. So the inner state is important. Of course, if you, there are certain kinds where it is clearly disrespectful. So the inner state where you see the divine presence, and that's why everything should be treated with respect. And you can't, for instance, kick the door saying that, okay, there is no picture of Mother and Sri Aurobindo. Somebody kicked and got hurt and he said to Sri Aurobindo, oh, I got hurt in the leg, hey, feet. He didn't speak about what he had done. So Sri Aurobindo says, naturally, if you kick the door, it will kick back at you. Simple as that. So Sri Aurobindo is asking us to go beyond the scriptures. So scriptures are a help, but scriptures can be a bar. Scriptures are a help if we catch the essence, rather than going into each word, its analysis, and based on that you derive its meaning, they are a bar. Because then you are caught in the web and maze of words. But scriptures are a help if you get the essence. What is the essence of the Gita? First, Sri Krishna. Second, Yajna. Third, Tyaga. Inner sannyas. Many others. So these are the essence of the Gita. Now if you start quoting, some people, you know, there are people who in India who remember the Gita verbatim. Even Savitri, people try to remember. Okay, that's fine, but that's more important is to live that truth. Otherwise we get caught, we even get proud that, well, I know the whole Gita by heart. But knowing the Gita by heart has no meaning if you don't know Krishna. I put it like that. And how do you know Krishna? You will never be able to catch him by the haze and maze of words. You can only catch him from the heart, by love, by adoration, by worship, true inner worship, by consecrating your life, making it into a yajna, a puja, inner puja. Then Krishna is caught. You can't catch him by telling him, imagine standing before Krishna and saying, see, I have remembered the entire Gita, and also your story as recounted in Bhagavad Puran, I must deserve a special place. He will say, my child, that's not the way. So this is what he is advising us, that read the scripture, but don't be caught up in the literal meaning of the words. And see how important this is as we read toward the end. Page 92. The Purushottam, from his high supremacy above the immutable and the mutable, has extended himself in the world and in the Veda. We'll talk about it. There will be many occasions, many chapters in which this will be elaborated. But what are Veda? Veda has come out of that supreme being. You can't place this above that. It's a very nice bhajan of someone. He says, Neti neti jako shruti gave so nandalal aaj janani ki baah pakad ke chalna sikhave. He says, I am surprised. Surprised to see that that supreme reality about which the Veda sings, the glory of, I see him born as a child and walking. His mama is teaching him how to walk. It's about Krishna avatar. Now that's the secret which Gita will describe in great detail. We'll reserve it for that moment. Because people often ask, what is the need of God to take human birth? Well, so that we can at least have a living example to become like God. But there are many other things besides. Still, the letter of the scripture binds and confuses. As the apostle of Christianity warned his disciples when he said that the letter killeth and it is the spirit that saves. If you have Surabindo standing right there and you have his books or all the books and you have to make a choice, fall at his feet. Of course, they are not either or. It helps him in coming closer to him. The books are important because they bring us closer to him. But if that is not the purpose, if it's only to brag about reading Sri Aurobindo's books and giving lectures and writing, then it has no meaning. Then we have not really understood. The real source of knowledge is the Lord in the heart. I am seated in the heart of every man and from me is knowledge. Knowledge cannot be superior to the Lord himself. When knowledge falls silent, then the Lord reveals himself in the heart. Says the Gita, the scripture is only a verbal form of that inner Veda, of that self-luminous reality. It is Shabda Brahma. The mantra, says the Veda, has risen from the heart, from the secret place where is the seat of the truth. Sadanada Ritasya Guhayam. So this is where the mantra. Mantra is only his utterance. And that mantra is not confined to Sanskrit or to some scriptures. That presence is everywhere. So everywhere there is the Veda, the knowledge of the Lord. Everything is a Veda, the unwritten Veda. That origin is its sanction. Why Veda and Upanishads are sacred, special reverence? Because they have emerged from the Lord. That is why it is sacred. Otherwise, it has no meaning. And emerged from the Lord, some rishi received that knowledge in his heart from the Lord. And he revealed it through a body of words. But still the infinite truth is greater than its word. Nor shall you say of any scripture that it alone is all sufficient and no other truth can be admitted. As the Vedvadins said of the Veda. So he's reminding us, see, this problem we have solved 5,000 years back. Sri Krishna solved it. But what is happening today in the name of scripture? This is a saving and liberating word which must be applied to all the scriptures of the world. When the Muslim says that Quran is the only one, when the Christian says Bible is the only one, or the Hindu says my Vedanta is the only one, or the Sikh says Guru Granth Sahib is the only one, you are making a fool of yourself in front of the Lord. Equally it would apply to Sri Aurobindo's. Oh, I have read the Life Divine, it is the only thing in the world. For you it may be the only thing, fine. But knowledge and divine reveals himself infinitely in the heart of his creatures and those who love him. And so he says, with this we'll stop. Take all the scriptures that are or have been, Bible and Quran and the books of the Chinese, Ved and Upanishads and Puran and Tantra and Shastra and the Gita itself and the sayings of thinkers and sages, prophets and avatars. Still you shall not say that there is nothing else or that the truth your intellect cannot find there is not true because you cannot find it there. That is the limited thought of the sectarian or the composite thought of the eclectic religionist, not the untrammeled truth-seeking of the free and illumined mind and God-experienced soul. So this where we'll stop. So wonderful it is. And we'll meet again, I think, after 2 weeks. Thank you.